This is the audio that accompanies the Neponset case, Neponset Property Owners versus Immigrant Industries Savings Bank. If you go to the slides, the first slide is trying to reinforce again the basic requirements under common law for having a covenant. It needs to be in writing. It needs to touch and concern, which we'll talk about here. We need to have intent. What's the intent? The intent that this is something beyond just a personal contract between the two parties, that this thing's going to run with the land. Horizontal privity, that is, that when the original two parties create the covenant, that creation accompanied some type of property transfer between the two. Someone selling the property to somebody else, and the covenant is a restriction on the property being sold, for example. And then, if we're not enforcing this or benefiting it to somebody who was one of the original parties, we're going to need vertical privity. That is, that when the benefited property gets transferred, if it was a pertinent, it was transferred with some kind of property interest or the burden property. And finally, we're going to need some notice. In a lot of circumstances, we're going to have record notice because it's going to be in writing, and we'll say, look, you constructively knew about this because you could go down to your local property office and find out about it. Writing, touch of concern, intent, horizontal privity, vertical privity, notice. Notice the requirements here are just bigger. They're just harder with covenants. Maybe it's because it's not about giving something to the benefited party, it's about restricting or maybe even forcing the burdened property owner from doing something. So let's go to Neponset. We're back before the Great Depression. I hope it's our only one. That we'll at least have heard about, and not a new one coming up. But in 1917, Neponset, which is a developer, conveys a lot to Dyer by deed containing the following information on it. Says, okay, look, we're going to convey this property to Dyer, but we're going to have this servitude. The heirs, successors, and assigns shall be subject to an annual charge, not however exceeding in any sum the sum of $4 per lot, 20 by 100 feet. Such charge shall be devoted to the maintenance of the roads, paths, parks, beach, and sewers. Time marches on. It turns out things aren't going that well. There are a lot of mortgages taking place, and the lot ends up being sold to the bank. This is the bank that probably was the mortgagee at a foreclosure sale. And so now they've got this lot that clearly the bank's not living in, even if corporations are people. And when you take that lot, if we take this language correctly, I've got to basically pay what I'm going to just call a homeowners association fee under this language. And the bank says, look, we're not going to pay. And I think the main reason the bank says we're not going to pay here is the bank at the current time owns a lot of properties that it bought via judicial sale. And we've got to cut costs. And one of the ways we can cut costs is saying that these things are not enforceable to us. And now the Neponset Property Owners Association, so this is the homeowners association, this is not the original developer, is the one that's going to try to enforce the covenant. And so they sue the bank and say, no, you need to pay your homeowners association fee. If we step back, let's figure out what type of servitude we're dealing with here. If we read the language, it basically means if I own the property, I've got to pay money. It's a certain amount depending on how big my property is. This would be an affirmative covenant or a positive covenant because it's forcing the burdened property. This is the lot that was owned by Dreyer but now owned by the bank. It's going to force me to do something, pay money, right? The burden is appurtenant. It's tied to the property. What's interesting here is the benefit, at least initially, this money goes to who? The homeowners association. They don't own any property. Here we actually have the benefit being in gross, that it goes to the property owner that's there. A couple other things that when we look at this, just to kind of reinforce some of our basics, do we have a writing? Yes, we've got a writing. Do we have intent that this is something beyond just a personal agreement? Yeah, we've got intent here. We've got our heirs, successors, and assign language. Do we have horizontal privity? We certainly have horizontal privity initially between Neponset and Dyer, right? Neponset's the developer. They own all these lots. They convey a lot to Dyer. With that conveyance, that's a property relationship. With that conveyance comes this covenant. So we've got horizontal privity here. Do we have vertical privity on the burden side? So what's the burden side? It's the side that's actually going to pay this homeowner association fee to the homeowners association. We do have vertical privity because Dyer sold the lot to the bank, even though it's a judicial sale. It was a sale. So we've got this kind of vertical privity between Dyer and the bank, and we've got vertical privity on the burden side. Do we have vertical privity on the benefited side? We're going to talk about this. This is one of the big questions in the case, because the question would be whether Deponzit, the developer, sold any land to the association when he transferred the benefit to the association. This is an open question, and we'll talk about that even more. So put a little question mark as to whether we've got vertical privity on the benefited side. Then the other question is going to be whether we've got touch and concern. We're going to talk about that next. And then finally, notice. We'd have record notice here. Why? The bank would be able to go back and take a look through the record, through the deeds, and see this written covenant that's there. And so coming out of this, what are the bank's arguments going to be? They're going to argue touch and concern, and they're going to also argue the fact that there's no vertical privity on the benefit side. Next slide, slide three. This gives you a sense of the beautiful area that we're looking at here. The arrow actually is to the house that was in question. You can click on this and kind of go around and dream about being out on the beach. I hope you're getting outside at least some. But these are the properties that are at issue. And you can see now these properties are doing quite well. You can actually also click and get to the actual Homeowners Association page, Deponzit.org. It's always good to see what's coming up. I wonder if they're still having, I guess they're having Zoom meetings now, probably. And they now have a community site on Nextdoor. We can only imagine what's going on there. Okay, so go on to slide four, and we get to this question about the touch and concern requirement. So we haven't talked about touch and concern. There are different approaches to touch and concern, and we're going to talk about a couple of them that are discussed in this case. And so the case initially says, well, let's see how those in England dealt with touch and concern. And the way they handled it in England is basically said, listen, if it's a negative or restrictive covenant, it always meets the touch and concern requirement. So if we go all the way back to the first hypothetical last virtual class where we had Abigail getting Beatrice to promise to only use her property for residential purposes, that would be a negative restrictive covenant. That would always touch and concern under the English rule. However, the English also had this real clear certainty where they said if it was an affirmative covenant, it never touches and concerns the land. So this means if I went back here and took a look at this covenant where I require Dyer or the bank to pay money, under the English rule, that doesn't touch and concern. And the case talks about the foundations for this. I think there's some real concerns, basically using the word servitude to its fullest extent. The fact that I buy a piece of property and maybe I'm prevented from doing something. That's one thing. But if I buy a piece of property, I'm actually now increasing my liabilities because I have to do something. I have to pay money. I have to cut the lawn. I have to do things. Those affirmative covenants almost come close to kind of 13th Amendment problems, right? That we're putting someone in some kind of servitude type of position. And so the English did not want to enforce those. And this is why if we go all the way back to Tulk versus Moxaw, if we interpreted that covenant to say that Elm or Moxaw had to affirmatively maintain the garden, it wouldn't have been enforceable. But if we interpreted it or wrote it in a way where it was a negative covenant, right, it can't be anything but a garden, let's say, I might be able to get the English to enforce it. Come over here on this side of the pond, and here are the New York Supreme Court or Appellate Court, Court of Appeals for New York, says, look, we're not going to adopt the English rule. We're going to come up with our own test. And we want to come up with a test that's a little more sensitive, mainly because I think in the end they want these things to be enforceable, these homeowners association fees. Because maybe on net these are beneficial. It prevents free riding by people enjoying the niceties of the beach and the common areas but not paying in to some kind of central kitty, right? And so it kind of solves a collection action problem, prevents free riding. And so the way they do it is they say, look, this is our test, and this is actually from the case. I'm not sure whether this creates much clarity, but we can talk about it here. Does the covenant impose, on the one hand, a burden upon an interest in land, which on the other hand increases the value of a different interest in the same or related land? Okay, so does that happen here? Does it create a burden upon an interest in land? Check. I have to pay $4 if I own this land. I'd say $4, depends on the size of the property. The bank's got to pay money. That is going to create a burden on that piece of land. Will it increase the value of a different interest in the same or related land? Okay, so this would be the question of whether it's going to increase the value of the benefited people. And the benefited people could be those who are surrounding the property, which it probably does, because when we pay into that central fund, it keeps all the common areas looking nice. It increases that value. It might actually also increase the value of the same land, right? The fact that I pay into a central fund under a covenant that's essentially what we call reciprocal, right? That all of the people have this affirmative covenant on their property. That would actually maybe even increase the value of the interest that I might have in my land, right? I own this thing in fee simple. This interest in this land, the value might be going up because we have to pay into the central kitty. Seems like I would meet that requirement here. One of the problems, though, if we look at this, and the court kind of starts to note about it, is there's a circularity problem here a little bit, right? The fact that it is a covenant just by itself will always burden the land burden the land that there's an interest in, which means that if we're looking for a burden being upon an interest in land, and that being an indicator of a covenant, well, covenants are always going to be creating a burden upon an interest in land. So there's circularity there. And then the question becomes is, well, look, if there's a burden on some land with a covenant, there's a benefit to somebody else, won't that always increase the value of a different interest in the same or related land? And the reason it'll increase the value is because there's some covenant for that particular land that's being benefited. And so there's a concern about circularity with the first part. Right. And so this, I think, why they have the second part of the test. We still need to look at whether the covenant is sufficiently connected with the use of the land, and must be in many cases a question of degree. It's still got to concern some usage of the land in question. And so here, right, does it involve the use of the land? Yes, it does. Maybe not necessarily the burdened property, but it certainly involves the use of some land that's involved here. It's a question of degree, right? And this might be less of a degree versus more of a degree. But we need this to get out of circularity. The hypothetical that I would have tortured you all with class would have been, let's say, the following covenant. I've got a next-door neighbor. His name is Sean. I don't, but let's say I do. I go over to his house. I say, hey, look, Sean, how about this? How about you promise to bake me a pumpkin pie every Thanksgiving? Sean says, fine. I'll do it. I'll do it, though, if you pay me $1,000. One-time fee. So that's fine. I said, but the one thing, Sean, I want to make sure of is that whoever owns this property is going to have to bake me a pumpkin pie every Thanksgiving. He says, okay, then let's do it in writing. Let's put the intent in there. If we are requiring horizontal privity, we could even use a straw person. We could transfer our properties to them. They transfer properties back to us. Sean's fine baking pumpkin pies. He got $1,000. He actually enjoys baking pumpkin pies. Sean sells the property to Jim. Jim now has the property. I show up the day before Thanksgiving and say, hey, Jim, how are you doing? Just want to let you remind you. Take a look at your property records. You need to bake me a pumpkin pie. Clearly an affirmative covenant. Is it create a burden on Jim's land? It sure does, right? The burden's going to vary depending on who does it, but it has to bake the pie, but it sure does. Does it increase the value in a different interest in the same or related land? So this would be the benefited interest. It certainly does mine. I might end up selling my property to someone who doesn't care as much about pumpkin pies. But just the fact that it's a covenant and it's creating something probably does increase the value at least a little bit, right, of getting this pumpkin pie every Thanksgiving. And so I think this becomes the circularity of the first part of the deposit test. Now, I think the second part of the deposit test maybe saves us here and says, look, okay, does that really have to do with the use of the land? Is it sufficiently connected? Right? Probably not. Right. In connection, let's say the covenant was you had to mow your yard every week. Right there, maybe it would be connected to the land, and we'd have enough in that particular place. If we move on to the next slide, we get a different approach. So we've seen two approaches there: English approach, deposit approach. The third restatement of covenants as another approach, and basically they say, listen, we're not going to do any of this. Fiction of saying, is it affirmative or negative, or this circularity test that the New York courts are doing. Let's call a spade a spade, and what we're going to do is we're going to use touch and concern to basically ask ourselves, is this a covenant we want to be enforcing? And there are just going to be some covenants that are illegal or unconstitutional or violate public policy, and we're not going to enforce them, right? And so the third restatement lists a couple of these. Is it arbitrary, spiteful, or capricious? My pumpkin pie one might actually be arbitrary. Is it unreasonable burden on a fundamental constitutional right? I've got a covenant. The covenant says that you can't display the American flag on your property. We might have some free speech concerns there. Servitude imposes an unreasonable restraint and alienation. I'm selling you this property. But you can only sell it to someone else as long as you sell it for over $2 million, and I get $1 million of that. That might be an unreasonable restraint and alienation. Wouldn't be enforceable. Servitude imposes an unreasonable restraint on trade or competition. I'm going to sell you this property, but you have to promise not to compete with me in the flower business or something like that. It would have to be a reasonable restraint. And finally, we won't enforce servitudes that are unconscionable. And so here we're no longer kind of doing this fiction about is it affirmative or negative, or does it actually increase value and decrease value and sufficiently connect to the land. Instead, what we're doing is taking a look at this and saying, okay, look, public policy-wise, is this something that we really want to enforce? And so I'm going to clip it here, and we'll start on the next slide, vertical privity, in the next audio.